Today on the TV Time Machine, we welcome the producer of A Charlie Brown Christmas, Lee Mendelson. Along with his partner Bill Melendez, Mr. Mendelson helped craft many of the most beloved animated specials of the past half century, including It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, and A Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. Over the next few segments, Lee Mendelson will talk about A Charlie Brown Christmas and Mr. Mendelson's classic animated specials and explore how, over 50 years later, the Peanuts Gang continue to be remembered and loved from generation to generation. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to try and kick that football, feel free to grab your security blanket as we come out of our shell in the present in order to enjoy a Peanuts-filled past. Lee, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Sure, glad to be with you, Jim.
Lee, now you were born in San Francisco, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, what was your life? Now, you're still there.
Yeah.
What was your life like in San Francisco growing up as a young lad?
Well, San Francisco is a fantastic city, as you know, and I'm a third generation San Franciscan, so I'm very prejudiced in its favor. My father was born here, and my grandfather was born here, and my great grandfather came in 1851 in the gold rush.
Wow.
So I've been steeped in the history of San Francisco, and before I opened my own company, I worked at the local television station, KPIX, where we did a lot of history shows, including the building of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Now, growing up, what were some of your interests, and was entertainment a part of them?
Well, I grew up in San Mateo. We moved when I was 10 years old down to San Mateo, which is down the peninsula, halfway between San Francisco and Stanford. Mm-hmm. And I went to San Mateo High School. And my main interests were writing, and was the yearbook editor, got interested in photography during that period. And then when I went on to Stanford, I took radio and television. In those days, of course, back in the 1950s, radio was much bigger than television.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, my professor recommended I go into radio because he felt television was just a fad. And I wrote a couple of plays that were performed there. So I got interested in all aspects of music and stage production and photography during those years.
Now, what inspired you ultimately to enter the TV business?
Well, I was working in my dad's produce company, and I was enjoying it. It's a kind of a dynamic, exciting, it's like the stock market, only with fresh fruits and vegetables. And I kept watching local documentaries, and for some reason I had the feeling that I could do those documentaries, you know, as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to various television stations in California, and just happened to walk into KPIX one day when a production assistant was leaving, and I took over her job on the spot at $100 a week, which was a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, when you were working at KPIX,
yeah,
you produced a documentary about Willie Mays.
No, that came later.
That came later?
Yeah.
Okay.
How did that go? What I did at KPIX was a series of history documentaries.
I see.
On everything from the Golden Gate Bridge to the 1915 World's Fair to San Simeon. And then I left in 1963 to form my own company, and that's when I did Willie Mays.
I see. Now, why did you choose Willie Mays? What was it about Willie Mays that fascinated you at the time?
Well, my father always been a huge baseball fan. The San Francisco Seals were an exciting minor league team out here for years.
Yeah, Joe DiMaggio played for them.
Joe DiMaggio came out of there, and a lot of others. Tony Lazzeri, Frank Rossetti. Mm-hmm.
All those Yankees, yeah.
Lefty Gomez. It was like a farm team for the Yankees.
Yeah.
And I was reading a book about Willie Mays, and I noticed that the author, Charlie Einstein, lived nearby in Marin County. And I called him, and I said, do you think Willie might be interested in doing a documentary? And make a long story short, we met with Willie, and he said, fine, and we followed him throughout the 1963 season. And then I went back to New York. It had only been the second time I'd been to New York, and I had a half-hour film in the can. And they asked me at NBC if I could make it a full hour, and I said, sure. And so NBC bought our first show. And it went on that fall in 63.
Now, that was pretty innovative. That was pretty innovative back then. I mean, they do that all the time now on ESPN, but really weren't doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was very innovative. They let us, because it was Willie, they let us shoot from the dugout, which nobody had ever done before.
Wow.
Most of the film before that is all from the press box in black and white. And we filmed him in the car going to work, which is, you know, an ordinary scene nowadays, but back then it was a big deal.
Right.
And got a lot of hate mail during the whole production. And
Because of the race situation?
Right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when the show went on the air, they wouldn't even play it in Birmingham, Alabama.
Wow.
And which is, was his hometown.
That's right.
And, of course, he encountered a lot of that in his career, you know, from the Negro Leagues up through the minor leagues. And anyway, somebody from the New York Times called and said, how's it feel going up against Taylor? And I said, Tony Taylor, the Chicago Cubs, will kill him. He said, no, CBS is doing the first big spectacular Elizabeth Taylor in London.
Right. Oh, yes, that's right.
And I said, I was very brash in those days. And I said, we'll beat her because the National League is in all the Nielsen cities, you know.
Right.
And we did very well. We got a very good rating. And, you know, thought we were going to be very successful, but the phones never rang after that.
Has that documentary been seen since? Has it only aired once? Because I can't find any evidence of its existence on DVD or anything like that.
It ran a couple of times, and then we did a different one and we did an update in 2000,
mm-hmm,
when they opened Pac Bell Park and dedicated the statue to Willie.
Mm-hmm.
And we've remained close friends all these years. He lives just about 15 minutes down the road from me.
Now, that had something to do, that documentary that you produced, with you producing A Charlie Brown Christmas. How did that come about?
Well, the whole thing was very serendipity-like. As I said, we didn't get any phone calls after Willie Mays, and I was reading a Charlie Brown comic strip, as I did every morning, and he was losing a baseball game, and the idea popped into my head that we had done the world's greatest baseball player, well, let's go do the world's worst. It's strange, you know, how you get ideas like that, but I found out that Mr. Schultz had his name in the phone book, which he did all his life, and I called him up in Sebastopol, California. He was a big baseball fan, and he had seen Willie Mays, and he said, well, come on up and let's talk. So I went up, and we got along really well, and we did a documentary on him.
Now, when you met him, did you feel an instant professional rapport with him?
We got along very well because, again, we shared this mutual interest in baseball, and he respected Willie Mays greatly, and we hit it off right away and, in fact, started filming like a week later. And there was just an instant connection there.
What were your biggest concerns while you were in the pre-production stage of A Charlie Brown Christmas?
Well, what happened was, after we finished the documentary, we took it to all the networks that liked the Willie Mays show, and for whatever reason, they didn't buy it, didn't want it, although we'd animated a couple of minutes in there. And so for 2 years, we didn't hear a thing from anybody. And then we got a call from McCann Erickson, a fellow named John Allen in New York, and he said, have you and Mr. Schultz ever thought of doing a Christmas show? And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, we represent Coca-Cola, and it's Thursday. If you could have an outline of the show to Atlanta by Monday, maybe we can sell it. Because Coca-Cola had seen the documentary, you know, 2 years before. So I called Mr. Schultz on the phone, and I said, I think I just sold a Charlie Brown Christmas. And he said, what's that? And I said, it's something you're going to write tomorrow. Because we had never any discussions about it.
Right.
So Bill Melendez, the animator, flew up from L.A., and he and I drove up to Sebastopol, and over the next 24 hours, we concocted the outline of A Charlie Brown Christmas, which really never deviated from that point all the way through production.
Now, did Coke make any demands or set criteria for the show?
No, of course not. Mm-hmm. In fact, the 40 years or more we've been producing, we never had any demands from the networks or from the sponsors. They always let us alone.
Now, at the time, did CBS have any concerns about your show?
Well, when we finished the show, Bill Melendez and I, it took about 6 months, and we thought we had ruined Charlie Brown. It just seemed like the show was really very slow. We took it back to the network, and they really liked it even less. The two top folks looked at it, and they thought it was too slow, and they didn't get the jazz score and the kids talking, and we used kids, real kids, to do the voices, and that had never been done before. Up to then, if there were kids on a cartoon show, they were done by adult voices.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the network really didn't like it that much. And the show came out Well, in fact, they said, you know, we wouldn't probably even run this, but it's in TV Guide. There's not much we can do, but nice try. And so, you know, between Bill and I not thinking it worked and they not thinking it worked, we figured we had a disaster on our hands.
Right.
So the show came out, and it had an enormous, I think it was a 45 share of audience, meaning 45% of the country watched our little show. Mm-hmm. Time Magazine gave it a great review. And the guy from CBS called the following Monday, and he said, well, we're going to order four more, but I just want you to know my aunt in New Jersey didn't like it either. So that was his justification. So that's how the whole thing happened, and it was all serendipity and all very weird. And, of course, it was very weird to go to the Emmy Awards and win the Emmy.
Yes. Especially when you thought you had a disaster on your hands.
That's right.
Isn't that the way it is sometimes in show business when they were shooting Jaws, for instance?
Yeah, right.
You know, Spielberg thought he had a disaster on his hands.
Of course. Well, when we'd been, you know, rushing it out, and I remember when we showed it and we were discouraged, one of the animators stood up in the back. I think his name was Ed Levitt, and he said, this show is going to run for 100 years, and we all thought he was crazy.
Very good.
So we're almost halfway there.
Give him a raise.
Yeah.
Now, Lee, one of the most enduring and endearing aspects of A Charlie Brown Christmas and all of your Peanut specials is the music of Vince Guaraldi, as we'll hear in the following clip. Now, this was really an unusual choice. What inspired you to hire Vince to compose your music for the special? Because your choice was really inspired.
Well, I always had been a big jazz fan. My dad had a lot of 78s of all the great jazz pianists of the 30s and 40s. And I was driving over the Golden Gate Bridge, and I heard Cast Your Fate to the Wind, which was a Guaraldi composition I hadn't heard before, but had just won a Grammy. And this was in 63 when we were doing the original documentary. So I called the jazz critic at the Chronicle, Ralph Gleason, and said, where does this Vince Guaraldi live? He says, he lives right here in San Francisco. So we met with him. The Cast Your Fate had that adult quality and children quality, both. That was the kind of music I was looking for, and so we signed up Vince to do the documentary back in 63, and he called me a couple of weeks later, and he said, I want to play this song for you to see if I'm on the right track.
Right.
And he played, for the first time, he played Linus and Lucy.
Hmm.
And I remember I got goose pimples all over because I said to myself, not only is that perfect, but I had some feeling it was going to have some long-range impact. I don't know why I felt that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very exciting moment. And then what happened after that documentary, which, as I mentioned, we didn't sell ever, 2 years later when we did the Christmas show, I called Vince up, and we used some of the music from, like Linus and Lucy from the documentary, and then he wrote the original score for the whole show, and went on to do the next 17 shows before his untimely passing.
I think what comes through his music is one word always comes to mind, and that's joy.
That's right.
And
he wrote with a lot of joy and played with a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. And again, it appealed to both adults and kids. And over the years, we heard from when we would hire various musicians to do our shows, like Wynton Marsalis or George Winston or David Benoit. As kids, they had heard all this music, and all of them had gone into music because of the Charlie Brown music.
Wow.
And they ended up doing scores for us on other shows. And it's just gone through, I think it's sold 3 or 4 million now over the 40 years, the original album.
Amazing. Was there any trepidation in any quarter about you using a jazz musician?
No, nobody thought anything about it. It had never been done before.
Right.
It probably has become, you know, it's become the most well-known jazz in history, probably, particularly around Christmas time.
Do you remember Charles Schulz's reaction when he first heard it?
Oh, yeah, he liked it very much. I don't think he was particularly a fan of jazz at that time, but I think he became one over the years because he liked it immediately.
Now, interestingly enough, Charlie Brown Christmas was not the first time that America was introduced to an animated version of the Peanuts gang, as we'll hear in the following clip.
If you can name just one car as beautiful and economical as a Falcon, I'll give you $1,000. I'll give you $10,000. If you can name just one. But you can't, because there isn't any car that looks so great yet still saves on gas like a Falcon.
There isn't?
Nope.
That's too bad. I could have used the money.
Lee, that was a Ford Falcon car commercial that you might recognize.
Sure.
Tell us about the gentleman who was the animator for that commercial.
Well, Bill Melendez had met Charles Schulz 4 years before I had, back in 1959. Mm-hmm. And the first animation they ever did was for this Ford commercial. In fact, the kids that were on it were quite young, the Linus and Charlie Brown kids. And 3 or 4 years later, we used them again on a Charlie Brown Christmas. So there was a linkage there.
That's great. That's great. Now, do you remember your first meeting with Bill? And did you guys immediately click?
Bill was working for a small company called Playhouse Pictures. And again, he had done this animation for Charles Schulz before. And we were going to do this documentary in 1963, and we had very little money. And I could only afford to do 1 or 2 minutes of animation. So he and I met for the first time down in Los Angeles and hit it off right away. We found out years later that his grandfather and my great-grandfather were both in San Francisco in 1851 selling mules and clothes to the miners. So there might have been a Mendelssohn Melendez back then. But we hit it off very well from the very beginning. And over the 43 years, there was never an argument or a problem between Mr. Schulz, Melendez, and myself, partly because we all respected each other's turf, and partly because we worked in different cities. We weren't under the pressure of a big studio. We'd meet once or twice a month, you know, and got along as friends first and as creative partners second.
What did he think of the Charlie Brown Christmas project?
Oh, he jumped right into it when I said to him, you know, we've got to do this outline tomorrow. He said, okay, come on up, we'll do it. And was very enthusiastic throughout, and even when he knew Bill and I were a little dubious and the network was dubious, he was very strong on it and felt it was going to be very successful. And he was right and we were wrong.
Do you remember what kind of ideas he had at the time? Was he able to implement all his ideas? And how did he work with you and Charles Schulz during that period of time?
Well, the beauty of Bill Melendez's animation for Charlie Brown was he didn't try to embellish the strip or make the characters more detailed. He literally made a seamless transition from the comic strip to animation because he just moved the characters. He kept them simple, and he kept the background simple. And that's why Schulz had liked what he had done on The Falcon and why he had total confidence in Bill to successfully bring it to television.
What kind of talents did Bill possess that people might not know about, above and beyond his creative skills?
Well, I might mention in passing that he was the voice of Snoopy in Woodstock.
Right.
And what he would do is he'd just talk a lot of gibberish, and then he'd, you know, speed it up 10 times. And so he's quite famous in that regard. And again, he was a very joyful person. Everybody who knew Bill, you know, he was just so happy and pleasant to be around and always very positive. And a great animator with a great history. I mean, he'd worked on all the key Disney movies, the Pinocchio, Dumbo, the whole works, and was considered by people, you know, throughout the animation business as one of the greatest animators of all time, not just for Charlie Brown, but for all the animation he'd worked on.
Well, Lee, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear, I'll be back in a lightning flash with producer Lee Mendelsohn, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.